2 Samuel 21, and we'll read up to our text, beginning with verse 1. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. And David sought the presence of the Lord. And the Lord said, "It is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death." So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the sons of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. And the sons of Israel made a covenant with them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. You remember the story? The Israelites were to kill everyone who was near. And thus the Gibeonites pretended with their moldy bread that they were from afar, that they might be spared. Joshua failed to inquire at the mouth of the Lord and thus made a covenant with them out of the will of God. And Saul, years later, he knew that, and so in his zeal, which was false zeal, put him to death. And thus this famine was upon the land. Verse 3, "Thus David said to the Gibeonites, 'What should I do for you, and how can I make atonement for atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord?'" The only reason we have been blessed is because an atonement has been made. Verse 4, "Then the Gibeonites said to him, 'We have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel.' And he said, 'I will do for you whatever you say.' So they said to the king, 'The man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining within any border of Israel, let 7 men from his sons.'" The sons are affected by the parents, aren't they? "Be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord." And the king said, "I will give them." But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the oath of the Lord, which was between them, between David and Saul's son Jonathan. So the king took the 2 sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, Armoni and Mephibosheth, whom she had borne to Saul, and the 5 sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she had borne to Adriel, the son of Barzillai of the Gibeonites, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. Then he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the mountain before the Lord, so that the 7 of them fell together, and they were put to death in the first days of the harvest, at the beginning of barley harvest. We'll not read the next 3 verses or so here. It tells how David went and transported the bones of Saul and Jonathan. And then we come down here to verse 14. "And they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan, his son, in the country of Benjamin, in Zelah, in the grave of Kish, his father. Thus they did all that the king commanded. And after that," and here we have our text, "God was moved by entreaty for the land." God was moved by entreaty for the land. 3 things here. Number 1, the needs of the land. Number 2, that it is God alone who can meet the needs of the land. And number 3, that God can be moved by entreaty to meet the needs of the land. First, look at the needs of the land. Here we, for 3 years, there was a famine in the land. Verse 1. We know what it is like to have a little drought. Not 3 years, but maybe 3 months of a drought. The lakes and the rivers go down, and the hay price and the cattle price goes up, and we feel a little effect of a 3-year drought. But this here was a famine, a 3-year famine. And we ought not, I conclude from this, that we ought not look at any drought or any famine as some mere accident. I mean, maybe God is saying something behind it. And maybe a lot, I wonder how many of the famine or droughts, famines, are caused by corruption in the leadership, just like this right here. I wonder how many dry meetings are caused by corruption in the leadership in the church, or at least his low spiritual condition at the time. But alas, we have a famine in this land of ours, don't we? I mean, I know you all know this and feel it in measure, just as I feel it in a very little measure. A famine in this land of ours, not a physical famine, but a spiritual famine. Like Amos said, a famine, not of bread nor of water, but of hearing the words of the Lord. Just last summer, last spring, they started up there in Sedalia an Evangelical Ministers Fellowship, and they invited me to come. And I said I would welcome that, more fellowship with the other pastors in the town. I went holding my breath, and after all the joking and so on, well, they finally got down to a little business. Hey, it was the first meeting I went to and the last one. And this Evangelical Ministers Fellowship, they came out with a thing this summer, a full-page ad in the newspaper, a full-page article in the newspaper, and it was entitled, In Defense of a Little Virginity. It was written by a Focus on the Family. And here in that whole full-page article, they didn't have one mention of God. They didn't have one mention of Scripture, one mention of heaven or hell, or any moral considerations. A famine, you see, of hearing the word of the Lord. Evangelical ministers. It wasn't psychologists. And you see, they left out God, and the very thing they left out is the very reason for all the immorality anyhow. So there is a spiritual famine, a famine of truth, a famine of righteousness, a famine of justice. I heard there a year or so ago that some thief out in California climbed up on the roof of the high school building. He was going to come in, break in, and pillage. And he fell through the skylight. And do you know, they ended up awarding him $1.5 million because they didn't have the skylight the way it ought to be or something like that. You know, a famine of justice. A scarcity of these spiritual commodities. A scarcity of spiritual reality. A scarcity of the presence of the Spirit of God. It is very slim in our land, as evidenced by the abundance of evil. Consider the abounding sin of idolatry. I understand that there's a revival, a great proliferation of alternatives to medicine. Maybe Dr. Campbell could tell us more about that. I mean, crystal healing and hypnosis and acupuncture. Anyway, things that have no basis scientifically. A proliferation of visualization and forces and powers and all these New Age concepts. Even the toys for the little children are evil toys, evil-looking toys. We're seeing an abandonment by God of our nation, a famine in the land. Consider the abounding sin of Sabbath breaking. No one cares anymore what they do on the Lord's day, keep their business open and so on. Consider the abounding sin of disrespect for authority, disrespect for authority, particularly of parents, disrespect, period, for anything. A couple weeks ago, I went down there to preach outside the high school. A crowd gathered of something like 20 high schoolers on their lunch break. They came up. They stole a pen out of my pocket. They took my notebook out of my pocket. They took the tracts out of my pocket and lit them on fire right in front of my face. They came from behind and snapped my ears repeatedly. No respect, you know. Consider the abounding sin of murder, the sixth commandment. I mean, we forget, don't we, that there's 4,000 little babies murdered by abortion every day. The Los Angeles mayor, Tom Bradley, here he appoints a Freddy Krueger Day. I don't know much about this character, but he's known for explicit violence and so on. It's no wonder that homicide goes up when these are the heroes. Yeah. Consider the abounding sin of immorality, the breach of the seventh commandment. What did we hear the other day? That 60% of the babies that are born in urban America are illegitimate? and not to mention sodomy. I mean, in 20 years, our nation has gone to acceptance of sodomy. And right now, they've got, you know, a bill and before the Senate and the House that is to legalize sodomy in our country. And it's open, it's raw. They glory in their shame. They don't bat an eye about it. And everybody's ashamed to back off and say it's wrong. And here, a year ago, I guess it was, out there in San Francisco, the gays put on a demonstration, and they backed the police into a federal building, and they broke the glass in the federal building, and then they took those pieces of glass and hurled them like a frisbee at the police, sliced their knees, and so on. Not one arrest was made, and yet, at the abortion clinic in Wichita, 2,600 arrests were made. Everything's inside out, upside down. Good for bad, bitter for sweet, light for darkness. Everything's perverted inside out. The gays say we're gonna make an all-out attack against the churches of America, and the only gods will be handsome young men. Look at the prison situation. America has the largest percent of population behind bars of any nation in the world. And the high schools are a battle zone. Look at the political situation. The rubber checks, unpaid debts at the cafe up there in Washington, D.C., a third of a million. Look at the ecclesiastical situation. That's the worst part of it. The biggest criminals are not those behind bars, not those so-called lawyers. The biggest criminals in the land are the men standing behind the pulpits. Crooked men, dirty men, rotten men, evil men. I mean, the fountainhead of the springs of life has been polluted. It's no wonder that the populace is so bad when the pew is so bad, when the pulpit is so bad.
Right.
That's just a little of some of what you already know, I know. But there's a famine in the land. The needs of the land are great. Second point is, and that is that it is God alone who can meet the needs of the land. It says here that in verse 1, David sought the presence of the Lord. He sought the presence of the Lord. Surely David was regenerate, and surely he knew the Lord. Of course he did. He was a man after God's own heart. But yet he took special steps in seeking the Lord, special times in seeking the Lord, special endeavor in seeking the Lord, special times of fasting, maybe special times of prayer and so on. Sought the presence of the Lord. It's possible for a husband and wife to be in the same house in one another's presence and yet not have that real intimacy, that cheerful, joyful intimacy, you know, and so it is. With God, David, he made special attempt to draw near to God. Why this famine? Why this fix? What's going on here? Lord, would you show me what must be done? He sought the presence of the Lord because it was God alone who could meet the needs of the land. And God is the ultimate cause, really, for the collapse of our society. As Ravenhill says, it's not this ism or that ism, but God is the chief enemy to America. And so he sought the presence of God. It is God who withdraws his presence. When he withdraws back, the enemy comes in, evil spirits come in. When light is withdrawn, darkness comes in. And so it was God that he must seek. It is God alone. He can meet the needs of the land. It is God who is reprobating our senators and representatives. He's reprobating them. Job chapter 12 says that it is God who deprives the chiefs of the earth of their intelligence. They don't have sense enough to do the very obvious thing. Here the nation is in debt, but they keep on funding the National Endowment for Arts, for pornography and so on. You know, they just do not have common sense. Johnny Carter, I wish you were president of the USA. You'd do a better job than the wisest man around, the wisest politician around. Now, it is God alone who can meet the needs of the land. What insanity, you know, that they go spending $2.6 million in sexual devices to control disease. What insanity, you know. They're just putting a Band-Aid over the wound. They're trying to deal with the symptom, but they cannot get at the cause because they're the only one who can get at the cause is God, namely the hearts of men. God is the ultimate answer here, who can meet the needs of the land. I heard some of the presidential debates, and you know, the thought occurred to me that I would say 80 or 90% of the problems that they're talking about in these presidential debates They cannot be healed or cured by legislation, but only by morality, spirituality. Their problem goes back, you know, to the family and back to the and right down to the heart. The heart is the problem, and God, He is the only one that can deal with the heart. The need is for a moving of the Spirit of God. It's righteousness that exalts our nation. And so the need can be met by God. And we look back, you know, over the revivals. We look back over history at the revivals. And there's the Welsh revival of 1857 when the taverns were emptied. I mean, it was dried up. Why? Because there was no demand. And the Welsh revival of 1905, illegitimacy dropped 50%. And how about the Great Awakening when Edwards reports licentiousness abounded, night walking, lewd practices, and so on? But when God came, all the towns were filled with love and with singing and with great joy. In 2 years, between 1740 and 1742, they said that 1/6 of the population of New England was converted. There was a Canadian revival of 20 years ago. It started up there in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and spread down everywhere, really. But spread got down into Winnipeg. So great was the presence of the Spirit of God. So many lives were being touched. There were so many shoplifted goods being returned that the big department stores saw it on their books. That's God meeting the needs of the land. I recently, well, it was just a week ago, Charles Leiter gave me a tape. It was an account of the revival in South Africa given by Errol Stegen. I had met these two brothers, the Stegen brothers, in 1975 when I was with the Charismatics over there in Germany. And they were invited to come and speak for a week, the Stegen brothers. And this Errol Stegen, he gave, in one of his messages, he was giving account of this revival that occurred in South Africa, and it had been going on already for 8 years, and that was 1975. And as I understand it, it is still going on. And so he gives the account. I wish you could all hear it. I know you wouldn't consider it wasted time. I'd like to buy more copies of it somehow and spread it around. But he tells in there the first third of the message is how God was dealing with his heart. I mean, really plowing deep, really getting down fine, really pointing out his pride and so on, really refining that gold. And then the first one that came was a witch. And how did you come? How did you hear about us? She hadn't heard from any human invitation. God brought her. She cried out for help. They went into a room. They didn't know how to deal with her, what to do, so they started singing praises to the Lord. All of a sudden, that woman fell down there and began swirling around like a tiger. And then she began to grunt like pigs, and then she began to bark like a dog. And 100, 200, 300, according to the account, evil spirits came out, and she was just totally transformed. She had the face of a witch, and all of a sudden, beauty came upon her face. They said every one of those witches and witch doctors that came, none of them came by human invitation, or at least the majority, something like that. They would always ask, how did you hear? And it was no human invitation, it was God. And so the revival grew. The power of God became so great that they were seeing something like, he said, sometimes 1,000 per week converted. And God was doing the calling. I mean, sometimes for a period of time it was just witches and witch doctors that came. And then for another period of time it was drunkards and drug addicts. And then for another period of time politicians. For another period of time ministers. And for another period of time children. And so God was just bringing him in like this. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. It was God. It's marvelous in our sight. And may God do it again for our land. Oh, while there's yet a few days, would God do such a thing again? The third point that I'd like to bring out then is that God can be moved by entreaty to meet the needs of the land. God can be moved by entreaty to meet the needs of the land. We glory in the fact, don't we, that God is immutable. He cannot be moved. He's a rock. But yet, on the other hand, we see here that God can be moved. He can be moved. I mean, He is infinite on the one hand, but personal on the other, and thus can be moved. He will respond to righteousness. When the Ninevites repented, God relented. And so God can be moved. Hallelujah. You know, it can be so frustrating when things won't move.
You put all your strength with your biggest wrenches you've got on that nut and that bolt, and you grunt, and you can't, you back off and say, I can't even move it. You know what it's like maybe to have a horse that won't move. I really laid the stick to him, but he wouldn't move. He went over backwards on me. And so God can be moved. Gladly God will move. The Spirit of God moving on the face of the water. And really, what is revival but God, the Spirit of God moving in power? What a wonderful hope, you see, that God can be moved by entreaty. Dynamite, it might move a mountain, but it won't move God. Money might move a businessman, but it won't move God. Entreaty moves God. God puts a high value on entreaty, doesn't he? 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 1, first of all, I urge that entreaties and prayers and petitions and thanksgiving be made on behalf of all men. Don't put a widow on the list unless she continues day and night in entreaty and prayer. Yeah, God puts a high value on it. Asking God, agreeing with God, reporting to God, requesting of God, entreaty, treating this matter with God, to deal with God, to plead with God, to ask earnestly of God, to beg, to beseech, to intercede. Entreating God. And we see it repeatedly through the Scripture, don't we? For example, back there with Moses. Here God said, I'm going to wipe them all out. But no, God was moved by Moses' entreaties to spare the nation. And in 2 Samuel 24, when David had sinfully numbered the people of Israel, it said, and thousands were falling at the sword of the angel, God was moved by entreaty for the land. And again, Manasseh, the wicked man that he was, yet he repented, and God was moved by entreaty to have mercy upon that wicked man. And many more examples could be multiplied. What was the one last night? Here, Dr. Campbell was speaking about Jeroboam and how that man, that king, got his hand froze, his arm was stiff, and yet God was moved by the entreaty of that young prophet, and so he was healed. And in church history, how God has been moved by entreaty. I read the story of Pastor Shi, H-S-I. He was raised up and saved by the grace of God back in the 1800s, a contemporary of Hudson Taylor. He was used in an apostolic way, and that man, after he was converted by all of the other Chinamen around him that knew him in that village, they mocked him and so on. And then his wife, who was not yet apparently converted, but yet not resistant, began to have some problems. I mean, especially when they would gather for a meeting, she would begin to act demonized. And so the neighbors, they all mocked him all the more. They said, look, that's what you get because you've forsaken the gods. And so Pastor Shi, he declared a fast, and he fasted for 3 days and three nights and entreated the Lord. And after 3 days and three nights, he went in, laid his hand on his wife, commanded the demon to come out. She was transformed and a glorious co-worker with him ever thereafter. God moved by entreaty. Jonathan Edwards, you know, we hear about that famous sermon of his, but he spent before that 3 days and three nights in prayer and fasting. The Hebrides revival in 1949, it was preceded by much entreaty of the Lord in prayer, repeated prayer, constant prayer, diligent prayer. Well, the question is then, are we on praying ground? First of all, the question is, are we saved? If we're not saved by the grace of God, God won't even hear our prayers or a stench to his nostrils. Forget it. Go home. But then even as a Christian, still, are we on good praying ground? I mean, we can be a Christian and still not on solid, good praying ground and good terms with God. I mean, there can be things that hinder. Shortness with a wife, it hinders your prayers, you see. Some besetting sin, it shorts the circuit. Some little thing, maybe. You know, about a month ago, I thought my van was all done in. It wasn't running right. No power, and just hard to get it started. What has happened? Surely it's blown something on the insides. I went down to the service station. Would you look at it? Just a quick glance, you know. And he says, it sounds like a vacuum hose. I told Jared to take the cowl off where we were looking underneath. And finally he got to look back there. And sure enough, just a vacuum hose. That's all it was. Just some little thing, you see. And it can really affect the whole. Some little sin, you know. It really causes a power drain. And so can short the circuit, you know, be with our prayers with God are not as effectual. Are we on good praying ground? We can be so bound up, so fearful, so afraid to ask, not near to God the way we ought to be, too casual, too unruffled, too cool, you see, to really get in there with God, at ease in Zion. Ah, these are some hindrances to prayer. Stagnant in spirit, Zephaniah says. We got the attitude that, well, God won't, he won't do good if I do seek him. He won't do bad if I don't seek him. Stagnant in spirit, God says, I'll come and I'll search Jerusalem with candles. Get right down here close and see what's going on there. And so, in Isaiah, it says in chapter 64 that God wondered, that he marveled, that there was no one who stirred himself up to take hold of God. To take hold of God, arouses himself to take hold of God. I remember when I was in high school, a senior in high school, there came a man, a freshman, out of the backwoods of Strawberry Point. Where did he come from? He was one of the sons of Enoch, a huge young man, 240 pounds, something like that. Couldn't believe it. And he was the smallest one of the three brothers. And I graduated from high school and went to a nearby college. And by that time then, this here freshman, McManigle was his name, he had become a senior. And so there was a wrestling meet. And this McManigle was to wrestle this other heavyweight from this other nearby town. You know, they were in competition. So they had a big boy, too. And so it became so well known that bets were being wagered up there at the college. You know, some of us were from that town and some of us from the other town, and so we were betting one another which one of our men was going to win. And so finally the meet came about, and there was McManigle and Silvers, and they were out there on the mat just rolling around, you know, wrestling around, and nothing was being accomplished. And finally, Silvers accidentally bloodied McManigle's nose. And McManigle, when that happened, he wiped that blood off of his face. He went like that, and he went out there and just locked horns with that guy. In 3 seconds, the meet was over. He flopped him to the ground. It was all done. You see, he aroused himself and took hold on the adversary. And so God says he is amazed that nobody will arouse himself to take hold of God. He's kind of puttering around, tampering around, just nibbling, you see, and not really getting in with God and really getting hold of things. Not really going for the kill, you see. I wonder, Lord, what am I doing, you know? I'm afraid this points my finger at myself. Not really getting in with God and wrestling in prayer and going for the kill on this, to see that soul delivered. Now, last spring, there was a woman who came. She had been coming for 2 hours. She'd ride 2 hours one way to come to service. And she really praised us to where, I mean, it just made me very uncomfortable. But nevertheless, a very loyal Christian. But alas, she was offended. She became offended. Offended because we didn't give enough return, love in return, and seek her out. And, I mean, the enemy got in, and she went all the way from signing her letters fondly to saying, Terry called her up, said, can we come over and see you? And she says, do not contact me anymore. Get out of my life. Man, we were devastated. Terry came over in tears to the office to report it. And so what a thing, you know, the enemy got in. And a brother, a sister that's offended is harder to be won than the bars of a castle. There wasn't anything we could say. She said, don't even call me. Don't write. What do we do? Well, we entreated the Lord. Entreated the Lord. And just about 2 weeks ago, we called her up. We overrode her wishes. You know, don't contact me anymore. We called her up. And for the first hour and a half on the phone, I mean, it looked like there was not going to be any way to get in with her. Sister, isn't there anything we can do to be reconciled? Isn't there anything we can do to, you know, pick up the pieces and bury the hatchet and go on? We're sister, we're brother and sister in Christ. And it looked like it was impossible, but God graciously began to come in, and after 3 hours on the phone, the channels were opened up. And still, she's got a root there that needs to be dealt with, but at least the channels are open, you know. And I know it was God. It was God, because we had a special time of seeking the Lord, and that was right when Wendy Klein turned around on the witness stand. And so I give credit to God for having mercy upon us in that and showing us the mighty power of his little finger. Oh, but we ought to pray to the Lord then that God might again come and bring glory in our land, that the land might yield her increase, the mountains peace, the hills righteousness, that we might see water on the thirsty and floods on the dry ground, that we might see a mighty move of the Spirit of God. Father, just a little time left. Oh, that we might see sinners converted to Christ and staggering out of their dens of sin and hiding places. We ought to really entreat the Lord. It says God was moved. God can be moved by entreaty. Entreaty for my long-standing sins personally. Moved by entreaty for that lost loved one. God can be moved by entreaty. And then moved by entreaty for our land. Our land. Our land. The USA. Alas, alas for our land. I could bring this message in tears. I ought to. At least I hope I'm weeping a little bit in my heart. But I hope this has been an encouragement to me that God can be moved by entreaty. I hope it's an encouragement. Amen.